funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What clues about other people do we take from their use of language, and are we too quick to judge those who make mistakes? To all those who roll their eyes at double negatives, split infinitives, and haphazardly scattered apostrophes, my guest today would ask, who decided what is right and wrong in the English language? Robert Lane Green is an international correspondent for The Economist, and while he cherishes the power of language, he worries that the demand of many sticklers for proper English conceals a sort of us-versus-them elitism, and worse yet, is based on rules born out of because-I-said-so obstinacy rather than linguistic logic. His new book is called You Are What You Speak, Grammar Grouches, Language Laws, and the Politics of Identity. Lane, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So you write in the book that language is tied into everything that we hold dear. So it makes a sort of sense that we're very protective of it, doesn't it?
Of course. I start the book with a couple of literal myths from, for example, the book of Judges and the story of the word shibboleth, where the Gileadites and the Ephraimites were at war and one tribe slaughtered the other. They knew who they were by their inability to pronounce the word shibboleth. So they would say sibboleth. And right there in one of our most cherished books in the Bible is the story of group A recognizing group B by a pronunciation. And this has been throughout our history. It's an extremely powerful subject. It's extremely emotive. I know that you probably know in public radio that if you make a purported grammatical mistake on the air, you'll probably get callers and emails and letters about it. So yes, it's extremely powerful for people. They take it very, very seriously.
We also have this tendency to elevate certain ideas about language so that they seem like sacred truths rather than ultimately arbitrary decisions.
Right. Well, some rules of our language are not arbitrary decisions. They are the result of natural evolution of a language. And so most of the rules of the English language are of that type. We don't even know that we know them, but any native English speaker is processing their language through a series of rules that have evolved over the last 1,000 years. But there are also a sort of layer of rules on top of that that have basically been exactly what you just described, which is one usage book writer's decision or his instinct or his gut feeling about a word. He writes it down as a so-called rule of grammar. And if that book is successful, then it influences other books. And before you know it, one person's preference has become everyone's so-called grammatical rule. And it's this kind of rule, not all language rules, but this kind of rule that I try to kind of push back on in the book.
Talk about John Dryden, because this is the whole rule about never ending a sentence with a preposition. And in fact, his inspiration for this was not the English language.
Right. John Dryden is almost no English teacher who might enforce the don't end a sentence in a preposition rule doesn't know that the source of this is probably John Dryden for the first time, the 16th or 17th century poet and essayist who wrote in his in one of his works that you shouldn't end a sentence in a preposition. And he had done this happily earlier in his own career in his own writings, but then was influenced by his writing in Latin, and he liked to sometimes compose in Latin and translate into English. And in Latin, it's impossible to end a sentence in a preposition. And in that time, in medieval Europe and late medieval Europe and early modern, the Latin language had so much more prestige than English or any other modern language that it was seen as the model to follow. So a lot of the things that we've assumed that just have to be correct were the decisions of early grammarians to model English on Latin, something that doesn't really make a lot of sense. Why not model it on Russian or on Arabic, for that matter?
We have for hundreds of years been lamenting that nobody speaks good English anymore. And you bring up the point, like, was there a time when everybody agreed the English language was at its apex?
No, absolutely not. It's one of the most fulfilling perspectives you can get in looking at this question, to just look at how long people have been complaining about the decline of the language. Another great writer in English's history was Jonathan Swift, the satirist and poet, and he wrote in 1712, now almost 300 years ago, that the language was in a state of near terminal decline, that various usages that he couldn't abide were becoming more and more popular. And so his solution to that was that English needed an academy of authors, distinguished authors who would make these calls for the mass of English-speaking users, something that, for example, France does have. It has the French Academy to rule on these questions. But we get a sense of that perspective. We see that 300 years ago, people were complaining about the state of the language. Strunk and White's Elements of Style, the great usage book that so many people love, was written in the early part of the 20th century by an Ivy League professor, Will Strunk at Cornell, in the view that his students needed all this guidance because clearly their English was going awry. So even 100 years ago at an Ivy League college, we had Will Strunk complaining that his students needed a lot harder heavy-handed guidance.
We were given that in high school and told to treat it with just a little bit less reverence than the Bible.
Right.
And I went to a Catholic school, so this tells you something. But a lot of those rules make perfect sense, and they are about good writing. And some of them seem to have been his, Will Strunk's, like, personal pet peeves.
Right. Well, it's sort of multi-authored. It's also was edited in mid-century by E.B. White, who put his own stamp on it. And it's not always clear which is which. But, for example, there are a couple rules that they have influenced so many writers and so many grammar book authors on that I think they really were just generalizing their own preferences. One of them is they don't like beginning a sentence with however in the sense of however we weren't able to accomplish it. They're okay with however hard we tried, comma, we couldn't accomplish it, but not the first version. However, many people have been doing this in English throughout its history for a very, very long time. So I don't know exactly where that peeve of Will Strunk or E.B. White's came from, but they were so successful that when I was in college, we were given the same book and I had my favorite professor, a history professor, would strike out any sentence that began with that kind of however. And I think that frankly, was just a mistake in their analysis of how English works.
Another thing that's really funny from that book, and you write about it here, is this strange rule about how to indicate possessive in a name that ends with the letter S.
Right. And it's almost the first rule in the book. It may be the very first one. And I believe they say that you can't, the word, if you say Charles's, Charles's should be indicated with only a single apostrophe, not an S after that. But then they make an exception for biblical names like Jesus and Moses. I have no idea where that rule came from. It's completely idiosyncratic, but it's a great illustration of the way an idiosyncratic preference by one or two authors can become listed in a famous book as a rule of English grammar or mechanics.
And there have, in fact, been people who went back and looked at, say, the King James Bible and found all kinds of language errors there.
Virtually every mistake you can think of is in the King James Bible or in the works of Shakespeare, the two great, you know, bodies of English that sort of began the early modern period. In fact, one of the great language book, or grammar book writers who influenced so many others after him was a bishop of London called Loth, who wrote an influential grammar, and he condemned, for example, the ending of a sentence in a preposition following Dryden, and put several other stamps on the language. And he liked to single out mistakes in quality English writing as an illustration of what you shouldn't do. And so many of his examples actually do come from either the King James Bible or from Shakespeare. It didn't seem to occur to him that if the King James Bible and the greatest author in the history of the language were doing it, maybe it was okay and maybe his intuitions were wrong.
What is the concern that people have had about other languages creeping into English?
Well, you know, English has always had, I think, as a strength, its relative openness to foreign words. But some people have resisted the urge to bring in words that seem to show off a little education when there's a perfectly good English one. And 100 years ago, when America wasn't yet a superpower, 200 years ago, when the British Empire wasn't quite yet at its height, we imported a lot of our terms for art and philosophy and so forth from languages like French and German. And often there was a perfectly good English word already available. So it's been condemned as a kind of showing off of a knowledge of another language, but not necessary to keep English expressive. A good example is some readers might, our listeners might know the word Weltanschauung, the German word meaning worldview, but it means worldview. Why not just say worldview?
And then there are pronunciation issues, too. Like, I have read the preferred pronunciation of N-I-C-H-E in most dictionaries in this country is niche. But people say niche, and then there's this question about which one is really correct.
Right. It's a pronunciation of a word that has been brought into English from another language. It's always a tricky one. The British pronounce the word fillet, that we say in English, American English, as fillet. And they write it with an extra L as well. We say garage, following the French pronunciation. They say garage, sort of anglicizing it. So how we handle bringing a word into English doesn't have clear, hard, and fast rules. If you follow the foreign pronunciation, you might be seen as pedantic or showing off. If you anglicize it too much, you might be seen as ignorant or unaware of the etymology and the origin of the word.
Is there that sense always that if we somehow don't speak the way others assume we ought to, that we're just not very smart?
Right. There's been a great big industry for quite a long time, at least 100 years, probably really the last 200 years. You can find these advertisements in early magazines and newspapers saying, does your English embarrass you? And these are advertisements for courses where you could learn new vocabulary words or avoid embarrassing mispronunciations or improve on your grammar. But they had underlying it this possibility that you might just humiliate yourself mm-hmm. by the way that you speak naturally. And so the natural human tendency is to try to kind of aim up with your language, to try to speak at a higher level and even more so to make sure that your children do. We all want to move up in the world. And so it's been a tendency to emulate the the English of the most successful writers and speakers.
There's an interesting subtext there, too, in a country made up of immigrants.
Well, there are America has always been a diverse country, not just through immigration, which is a big source of that diversity, but also just regionally. The country is you can just do a massive 1,000-page atlas of the variety of American English. It's been done. These books are wonderful and fascinating because you can see immigrant words surviving in certain large cities, for example. A word like bodega used more commonly in a New York City than it might be used in, say, Atlanta or Omaha. And then you also see the great regional variety that's always been here. Southern English is clearly different from Northeastern English in ways that listeners here in Texas and me being from Georgia are certainly familiar with. So diversity is a natural fact of language. I can't really say that enough because it's always been that way. It's true now. It's been true forever in English. And it's true of every other language in the world. So what I push back on against in the book is the idea that only one form of English is appropriate for all situations, for all people, all the time. That's not so. There is a thing called standard English that we should learn, we should teach children, especially immigrant children, people who are already sort of in an outsider group, because they need it even more than those people already at the top of the pyramid. But at the same time, we don't need to try to crush out or eliminate all of that diversity that makes us who we are. I know the people of Texas wouldn't like to be told that they have to get rid of y'all and get rid of all the many things that make Texas English, Texas English, and start speaking like people in, say, Minnesota do. That's something that I would resist as a Southerner myself completely.
Robert Lane Green is my guest. He's an international correspondent for The Economist and author of the new book, You Are What You Speak, Grammar Grouches, Language Laws, and the Politics of Identity. We would love for you to join this conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. We're taking a quick break now. I'm joined by senior producer Jeff Whittington to talk about how, among other things, you can receive as a thank you gift a copy of You Are What You Speak. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Yeah, at the $120 membership level, we'd love to say thanks when you join today at kera.org or by calling 888-694-6931. We'd love to send you your very own copy of Lane Green's book, You Are What You Speak. It's been really well received. And Lane's been on tour, and we were talking
much
about
argued over, which is always great.
And I got to say, if I sound a little hesitant, it's because I'm always just really nervous about trying to talk on the radio when we have a guest who's an expert at these things. But we'd love to hear from you, and it's really crucial that we do hear from you. It is the fourth day of the drive, and we've made great progress. I want to thank everyone who has done their part during the membership campaign, but we're still waiting to hear from you either at the website, kera.org, or on the phone, 1-888-694-6931.
Your support allows us to bring in guests from all over the country and all over the world to talk about the things that will interest you. One of the wonderful things about this show is that we're not limited to any particular topic, so we can talk about language in this hour, and the next hour we're speaking with an ultra-marathoner who has run literally across the United States in a matter of 52 days. Mm-hmm. All those things are interesting. They all sort of contribute to your understanding of the world around you. And your support as a listener is fantastic, but your support financially is what actually makes this possible. We'd love to hear from you now at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. And we do still have that daily drawing going, right, Jeff, for the iPad 2.
That's right. The first 9 days of the drive, each day we're drawing for a lucky iPad 2 winner. You're entered into that drawing when you make a contribution at kera.org or via the phone at 1-888-694-6931. You're not legally obligated to contribute, but if you can, you should, and you can read all the rules and everything online at kera.org.
Again, if you want to make a contribution at or above the $120 level today, you can receive a copy of Robert Lane Green's new book, You Are What You Speak, Grammar Grouches, Language Laws, and the Politics of Identity. We also have other thank you gifts if you are interested in such a thing. You can find them all when you go online to kera.org or ask about it on the phone at 1-888-694-6931. We'll resume our conversation in just a moment with Robert Lane Green.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert Lane Green. He's an international correspondent for The Economist. His new book is called You Are What You Speak, Grammar Grouches, Language Laws, and the Politics of Identity. Lane will be speaking tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth's Young Professionals Group. That takes place at 7 o'clock at the Ginger Man. You can find information about the appearance at dfwworld.org. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, ask a question, maybe bring up one of the things that makes you crazy. We would love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. You offer a critique here about some of the things that we have taken from, popular science and assumed to be true. And there was this book a couple of years ago called The Female Brain. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The Female Brain is a book by a doctor based in San Francisco called Luann Brizendine. And she wrote about the differences in male and female brains. And I'm not really qualified to speak to most of her writing about that subject, but she did make a claim that just made waves and went rocketed through the internet. She said that women use 20,000 words a day and men use only about 7,000 words a day. And this got people blogging and commenting and online and saying, well, of course, everybody knows that. My wife just never shuts up. And it was something that everybody immediately accepted because it seemed to punch some button that everyone just really they got everyone going. The thing is, though, that a linguist at the University of Pennsylvania named Mark Lieberman read this and said, this doesn't sound right to me, and I've never seen any research that says anything like that. So he looked at her references, and she referenced a self-help book, and he found that book and looked at that. And that book had no research on the subject noted at all. So, in fact, nobody had done the research that claimed this at all. And since that book came out and this claim went around the world, somebody finally did do the research and published it in the magazine Science and found that, in fact, women speak about 3% more than men do, which is a trivial difference, not almost three times as much. But the claim about 20,000 versus 7,000 was the much more exciting one, and it was in a book that made lots and lots of waves. Not so many people get Science and read its studies, so that one's going to stick in a lot of people's minds, despite the fact that it's just not true.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Again, the email address is think@kera.org. Speaking of women, we should go back for a minute to Jonathan Swift. Who said essentially that the English language, would be even better left to women than to scholars and courtiers and people in his day.
He really headed in for poets and young people and the people hanging around the court, right? He said that they were the ones ruining the language. And he had a funny peeve about ending a word in the ED ending for the past tense in a word like rebuked. At the time he was writing, 1712, this was in a transition where before that ending had almost always been pronounced. You would say rebuked. And it was becoming rebuked, and poets were putting an apostrophe in, apostrophe D, rather than spelling out the ED as a way to indicate that it should be shortened to rebuked. And he couldn't stand this, and he said, this is what the poets and the courtiers and the fops, as he called them, are doing to the language. And so he said, I'd rather leave the language to women. And I thought that was quite striking. It really dates that essay.
It is funny, though, that we always blame teenagers. And, you and I were teenagers at one point, and I'm now 40 years old, and I don't speak the way I did then, but I don't think Generation X did that much damage to the language.
I don't think that any generation has really done fundamental damage to the language. It's, things aren't the way they used to be, but then again, they never were is the way to think about that one. We can go back to Cicero in the height of the Roman Empire complaining that the Latin he heard around him on the streets was what he called disgraceful. And he got so grouchy about it that he said, I don't even bother correcting people anymore. I just keep the correct way to myself. And he just got sort of despondent in his old age. So the kids ruining the language has been a theme across the world and throughout time. I don't think there's anything special about Generation X that this time it's really happening when it wasn't true in Will Strunk's time or in Jonathan Swift's time or Cicero's age.
I think this is really interesting, and you have some interesting stuff about this. I think the use of the word like as a sort of placeholder in a sentence probably started with my parents' generation and then moved through mine. I don't do that as much as I did when I was 16.
Right.
It's there occasionally. Why is that so common among younger people, and why do we grow out of it?
I'm not sure why like became the placeholder in particular, but placeholders are universal. Every language, every speaker has a placeholder. More competent speakers will use them less, but I was listening to the show that preceded this one on the headphones and heard quite a lot of and So a lot of adults, they pause and they rephrase while they're in their mind while they're speaking, and they'll say or They might not say like teenagers do, but they're leaning on that pause filler. And if you look at other languages, I always find it's interesting to listen to French people when their pause filler is it's just a little bit different. And then Israelis will say, eh. And so everyone has a pause filler they use. Almost no one has no need for the occasional pause filler. It's just that like has been the one that the teenagers use. And it's not really better or worse. I think the reason you grow out of them is that as you get older, you become a more fluent and confident speaker. Those pauses are part of a process of thinking how to say what you want to say better.
It's funny on this show because we occasionally interview people over the phone, and there are some people who don't use those placeholders to say, and I'm still speaking, and so they'll pause for a moment, and I'll jump into the next question, and then they'll continue answering what they started before. It's almost more awkward if you don't have that as a clue to say, I need another second, but I'm coming back with something.
Right. I think that one way to handle that is to maybe slow down a little bit, and that will help you process at the same speed that you're speaking. But as I just mentioned, Mark Lieberman, the linguist at University of Pennsylvania, who debunked this claim about women speaking three times as much as men, he posted an essay on his blog called Language Log, where he just said language is hard. Producing competent English in real time at full speed is actually a ton of different challenges, mental, physical, with the coordination of your lips and teeth and tongue. And so the fact that people make mistakes shouldn't be some kind of, oh my God, the language is going down the tubes. People have made mistakes in every language in every period of history. And if you followed any one of us around with a microphone for a full day and then transcribed every word that we said, I guarantee you could follow Demosthenes or Cicero or anyone around today and you would find the same exact thing.
Let's go to the phones now. Our first guest is Jaime in Dallas. Hi, Jaime.
Hi. Good afternoon. I was calling because in Dallas recently I've been listening to the name of the town Rio Vista, pronounced as Rio Vista. And it's spelled R-I-O. I wondered if you could fill me in on why they're pronouncing it Rio.
Right. Well, I can jump in on that. There's certainly a great tradition behind this. We anglicize all kind of words that we've taken from foreign languages and towns. There's Cairo in a couple of different states. So the city we otherwise know is Cairo when it's in Egypt. There's Versailles, Kentucky, named after, of course, Versailles in France. So if a Rio became anglicized as a Rio, it would be in a good tradition. And I went to college at Tulane University in New Orleans, and I saw how a lot of the French names in that city, you think with the French influence there, they'd pronounce them all correctly, but the street spelled after, named after the French city of Chartres is pronounced Charters. So sometimes these things are just a little bit unnatural for English speakers, and so they'll sort of fit them to English phonology a little more closely.
My sister went to UT, and of course there's Guadalupe is a thoroughfare through the town, and having been raised in El Paso, someone told her to get on Guadalupe, and she couldn't figure out what that meant because she was looking for Guadalupe.
Right, and through the heart of Atlanta we have Ponce, which is the street named after the Spanish explorer Ponce de León. So everybody calls it Ponce, and that's just the way it's going to be for Ponce.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Tim in Dallas. Hey, Tim.
Hi, I got a question. I do a lot of writing, and I'm always torn between the use of A and before a vowel or a vowel sounding like H. What's your take on that? When I grew up, I was told I got to use an hour, you know, and now it seems to have crept in. It's an A hour or A history. How's your take on that? One of our main morning news vocabularists, correct writers, used to always say A history and A hour.
Right. Well, you mentioned two different words starting with H there. Hour starts with a vowel sound, even though it's got an H in the writing. And so most people, I would say the correct usage is an hour. Some people will say a hour. You hear it in Black American English, for example. But the correct standard English is definitely an hour. History and historical is a weird one on the line where a number of people do say an historical investigation and other people say a historical investigation. If the H is pronounced, if you hear that h sound of the H, then most people will not put the an in there. But for some reason, history and historical straddles that line. You get a mixed usage there. I tend to say a historical novel rather than an historical novel because I pronounce that H. But that's one of the rare cases that actually sits on the line. Otherwise, you usually have a pretty clear distinction, a horse and our.
We have an email here from John in Frisco who wants to know whether you think Twitter and text messages have any noticeable effect on how English is spoken.
Well, one of the clear influences is that people not long ago started speaking a lot of the acronyms that became popular first on the internet through Twitter and blogs. Yeah, OMG, WTF. I can't spell that one out here on the radio, but everybody knows, I believe, what it stands for. Those were recently actually put in the Oxford English Dictionary because so many people had started saying them and even using them in speech as well as writing them that they were considered sort of proper little word units in their own right. So they are influencing the language on the sort of lexical level, i.e. they're just contributing words to the language and phrases to the language. But I don't see a sort of more profound influence on grammar and usage of the language overall. Most kids, even if they spend all their time texting and Facebooking, when they sit down to write their term paper for English class, they tend to know that that's a very different kind of writing. And I don't see somebody sitting down saying, OMG, Edgar Allan Poe was the greatest writer that ever lived. I mean, a teacher could prove me wrong, maybe showing me that, but I haven't seen any real world examples of people doing that kind of thing.
You know, it's interesting that we tend to sort of assume that younger people won't figure it out the way we have. Right. The way you talk to your friends is not the way you write for The Economist, I would imagine.
No, absolutely. And the way I speak in New York is not like the way I speak when I go visit my family in Macon, Georgia. So most of us know at some level that there are different kinds of language that are appropriate for different circumstances. And then there's usually a pretty clear distinction between writing and speech. Speech is hugely variable, always has been, always will be, by circumstance, by region, by formality or whatever. But in writing, we tend to stick to a thing called standard English. But even now, there are so many different ways to write. Before, most writing was done in longhand, in long form, long letters and essays. Now we have so many opportunities for very short, informal bursts of English, Twitter and Facebook and blogs, that we're starting to see more writing that incorporates a really informal kind of register. But that, again, people who do that kind of thing tend to have a pretty good knowledge that that's not appropriate for a term paper in college or in high school.
Robert Lane Green is my guest. He's an international correspondent for The Economist and author of the new book, You Are What You Speak, Grammar Grouches, Language Laws, and the Politics of Identity. You can join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. We're going to take a quick break right now to remind you that we are in our spring membership campaign. This is one of the few times per year when we come to you to raise the money that we need to keep the station operating. 61% of the money that keeps KERA on the air and serving you every day of every year comes from people just like you who decide to send in a few dollars, maybe a few dollars a month, maybe $100 or $200 a year, to strengthen the station and allow us to bring you the programming that you count on. If we didn't have you, as we've joked, you know, 61% of every hour would be blank, would be dead air.
Yeah, the show would already be over.
it would be terrible.
We'd had to stop, I don't know, 10 minutes ago or more than that, actually. Well, no, that's not quite right. Here I am trying to do math on the air again. She's Chris Boyd. I'm Jeff Whittington. And this is definitely the pledge danger zone territory, this topic. Many of you are holding on the phone right now. We're getting stacks of emails.
You got that number memorized.
That's right. You sure do. You're able to. But, you know, we're not going to do any show right now. Right now, we're giving you an opportunity to call 888-694-6931 or to log on to KERA.org and make a contribution. And I do actually think about these things. You know, is this topic going to be too interesting and people aren't going to want to tear themselves away and make a contribution? It really is important that you make a contribution. We do these membership drives because that's what is required with our license with the FCC, and it's part of how it works. And really, there's no other way to contact you as efficiently and as easily. And we set it all up so that it's really easy for you to do during this time. There are people waiting to take your call. The website's all, you know, humming along perfectly right now. It's all tuned up so that you can make your contribution there. So we really, really do need to hear from you today.
We know how many of you, even when we are not in fundraising drives and don't have copies of our guest books, today at the $120 level, we have copies of You Are What You Speak. We know that you go to the bookstore or you go to the library or you find these things. If you can listen to a conversation and be motivated to take action because you want to learn more, we would ask that you think back and acknowledge the source of that information, the thing that made you think, I have got to read that. I've got to find out more about this. I've got to look up that or check and see if I agree or disagree with what a guest had to say. We know how deeply you engage with the show because we hear from you a lot, and it's a wonderful thing. We just ask that you take that engagement as far as your wallet. And the reason that we don't have one specific amount, we don't say join KERA and it's $200 a year or it's $20 a year, is because all of you are in different places with your budgets. And we get that. You know, it may be a better year this year or a worse year this year than last. So you make the decision about how much you want to contribute. If you can do, you know, a friends level membership at $1,500, that's fantastic. If you're in a place where maybe you're a student and you can do $20 this year, we welcome it and love to have you on board.
That friends level membership, by the way, when you become a sustaining friend of KERA. It works out to $125 a month. It's right for some of you. There's also perhaps this is the trigger to get you to participate in your public radio station as more than just a listener. The $350 level will give you the Ken Burns collection. It includes the Civil War, the National Parks, baseball, and the war, all four of his multi-disc series. Documentary series. It all adds up to 61 hours and 29 DVDs at the $350 membership level. It's a great deal, and you're supporting KERA 90.1 at the same time. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to read your name. I saw some names on the screen a moment ago, and they disappeared. I think the first one was named John Fedorko in Grand Prairie. Ryan and Christina Lee in Rockwall. Thanks also to Hui and Kelvin Porter in Dallas, and Lois and Doug Young in Dallas. Thank you so much to each of you. We are waiting to hear from you, though, at KERA.org or at 888-694-6931.
Again, at the $120 level or above, you can choose as a thank you gift a copy of Robert Lane Greene's new book, You Are What You Speak, Grammar Grouches, Language Laws, and the Politics of Identity. Really interesting read. A great, I think, fodder for discussion, as we're finding out this afternoon, and the sort of thing you might even want to pass along to a friend or a spouse after you've finished reading it, maybe someone you've discussed language with in the past. You know, I was thinking about this, Jeff, this morning when I was driving in and listening to the membership campaign, and I thought, I'm kind of like a friends level member with the phone company right. and my insurance company and a whole lot of other corporations that I don't feel nearly as tied to and fond of as KERA.
Yeah, if you think about how much you spend on your iPhone bill or just on your other phone or your any smartphone bill every month, if you multiply that times 12 and think about what you get from KERA, of course, you know, none of us could live without our smartphones or our phones these days. But could you live without KERA?
You would miss it.
Call us, 888-694-6931. Could you live without your KERA app?
That is super cool. Yeah, if you haven't downloaded this yet, we have it for the iPhone, and do we have it for the Android?
It's coming.
It's coming for the Android. Okay, we're thinking about you Android folks. This is an app that allows you to interact in brand new ways with the content. You can get to the podcast. You can get to live content. That's something that we've made available to you without a charge. But of course, it costs money to develop these things.
Yeah, go to KERA.org/app to check it out. While you're there, make a contribution at KERA.org. Please do your part right now. Again, the phone number is 888-694-6931. The web address, KERA.org.
Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert Lane Greene. He's an international correspondent for The Economist and author of You Are What You Speak, Grammar Grouches, Language Laws, and the Politics of Identity. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Lane, I remember in college taking a journalism class, and for the first time, somebody made a big deal about split infinitives, which was very hard for me because no one had ever cared much before, and I had spoken and written that way my whole life. Why is this wrong?
Well, I don't think it's wrong. You'll notice that, for example, if you read the New York Times closely, it doesn't observe the ban on the so-called split infinitive. There was somebody in a number of writers in the 19th century decided that the infinitive was a single unit of English, and it wasn't really two words, despite the fact that it very much looks like it is, and so that nothing could come between two and the verb that follows. But that's not native to the English language. Again, I think that it probably was imported from Latin infinitives, which were one word and always are, and so can't be split. The fact is that English had split infinitives in it in literary writing since the 14th century, and one usage book I know found examples in every century, going back to Sir Gawain and the Green Knight in the 14th century, that poem. And so the split infinitive is native to English. It always has been. And it was only first prescribed, forbidden, by an anonymous author who gave his name only as the letter P in a magazine in 1834. So the pushback against the split infinitive is actually very late in the history of English, only in the 19th century. Before that, people had happily split infinitives.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Andrew in Dallas. Hey, Andrew.
Hi. My question is basically about the use of, I would assume, the past participle. I noticed that my girlfriend and I use it differently, whereas I would say something like, the dog's nails need to be trimmed, and she would just say, dog's nails need trimmed. And I was wondering which is correct, and if I'm incorrect or if she's incorrect, why would someone use that particular thing, or is it regional or whatever? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Great. Well, you know, in standard English today, I think you're correct. The dog's nails need to be trimmed. There are people who have done the dog's nails need trimmed usage. I don't know exactly, to be honest, if it's a regionalism or if it's just a kind of an occasional shortening. But definitely the standard English for that is the dog's nails need to be trimmed in its full spelling out.
How does something, not that specifically that usage, but how does a new novel way of using the language make that jump from improper English to respectability?
Well, these changes take a long time. You know, anything when it's new tends to be criticized as an error. And I suppose you could say by definition, if the language is okay as it is, then when somebody starts doing something different from the standard, you could say, you know, by definition, that's an error. But a lot of these things, they're made for a reason. And once they catch on so that the vast majority of people are doing this or that, then we can't really, at a certain point, the battle is over. And it is won by a usage that takes over the vast majority of speakers. I mean, one example, I would love to keep around the phrase to beg the question. It was a rhetorical device to try to sneak your conclusion into one of your assumptions. So you were trying to beg the conclusion in one of your premises. It was a technical term of philosophy or argumentation. Now people just say, well, that really begs the question. If she wore that at the cocktail party, what she's going to wear at her birthday party.
It means
something totally different. But the thing is that the overwhelming usage now is to use beg the question to mean just raise the question. I like the old usage of it, the traditional one, but the thing is that if I use it and don't explain what I mean, I'm going to confuse about 95% of readers or listeners. So that one is pretty much over the hill. The new usage has taken over, and I might say I don't like it. I like the old one, but at this point, that one's no longer really going to be able to be revived.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Don in Fort Worth. Hi, Don.
Hi. I'm thinking about the two words speak and talk. Now, I know that speak is a verb and talk can be either a verb or a noun, but in the verbal sense, I'm wondering how you feel about whether these words are totally, utterly interchangeable or if they have specific separate meanings as verbs. And I need to stay on the air on the phone because I don't have my radio on.
Okay, I'll put you on hold and you'll be able to listen on the phone. Thanks, Don.
Right. Well, speak and talk are overlapping, but not 100% overlapping. So I can say I'm talking right now or I'm speaking right now. That's a case where they do overlap. But you mentioned that talk also has a noun form that speak does not. You'd have to make speech the noun form. And then there are specific usages for speak. Like, for example, I say I speak Portuguese. I don't talk Portuguese. Some people do say that, but that's generally considered an error. So they overlap in about, I don't know, 80% of their usage, but not 100%.
We should say you not talk, but speak nine languages. I wonder if the more you learn about how everyone else speaks in different parts of the world, the more relaxed you're able to be about the things we do in English.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, a lot of the so-called errors of English are exactly the standard way to do something in, say, French or Danish. And so, you know, a lot of times the rules like don't end a sentence in a preposition are given as logical rules that sort of based on some of our first principles from heaven, when in fact they may or may not just be quirks of English. And even if they are quirks of English, that's all they are, and they're completely violated in another language. For example, you can split an infinitive in Danish, and you can end a sentence with a preposition in Danish. Danish I mentioned because my wife is Danish, so that's one of the languages I speak, and also because it is related to English. It's in the Germanic family. It's a cousin of English, genetically speaking, and so those rules have the exact opposite form in a language that's closely related to our own. So it does give you a perspective on where rules come from. They don't just come from the heavens in fully logical form.
And then in a language like Spanish, you have to use a double negative.
Absolutely. Spanish, Russian, French uses two particles, je ne sais pas. Ne and pas are two negative particles that are both needed in order to say to negate a sentence. So there are all pretty much every prescriptive rule you can think of in English is a violation of some other rule in another language. So that's not to say we should import our rules from other languages, but it does mean that rules are sort of contingent things that come from history. They don't, again, come from heaven or from pure logic.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up, we have Max in Duncanville. Hi, Max.
Hello. I was wondering, I hear all the time, as the object of a preposition, people say, between you and I. They're afraid to say me, and I always carry my family on it, but now it's starting to get to me, and I'm saying it. Is this just the evolution of language, or should I continue my fruitless fight?
Should Max hold out?
I'd hold out on that one. I don't like between you and I. And here's why. It's something that linguists themselves describe in the word with the word hypercorrection. It's people have been taught not to say me and my brother when they're supposed to say my brother and I are going to the store. And so they've been corrected out of that so many times as children that they assume me and my brother is always wrong. When in fact, if you say I share this between me and my brother or my brother and me, it has to be me. It shouldn't be I. But people have hypercorrected and added that I in, extending it past where it should go. And in standard English usage, that's wrong. It is growing and growing. I'd say it's one of those things that's in flux. You hear a lot of people saying between you and I, but between you and me is still more common. And sticklers and I think even sort of descriptive linguists would agree that the between you and I is a hypercorrection to be avoided.
Next on the phone, we will go to John. Whoops. John in Fort Worth. Hey, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. With the text, to send a text or text someone on the phone, my son and my wife both say, I texted someone. I understand it can be a noun, but if you're texting someone, that's a verb as well, and you don't say, I ran to the grocery store. You say, I have to run to the grocery store. So I was just curious what your thoughts on that were, whether you should say, I text someone or I texted someone.
In the past tense? I'm a little confused by the question.
Well, if they're saying, for instance, my sister-in-law, if my wife texts her, she'll say, well, I just texted Megan, and I think it should be, I just text Megan. But they refer to the actual verb usage of it and the... I don't know if I'm making any sense here.
Okay, I think I see what you're getting at. Well, run is an irregular English verb, so it's run, ran... in the past tense. And so when we coin new verbs in English, they almost always take the regular endings. And so text is obviously a new one. It's come in the last 10 or 15 years. And so when we import a word like text, first it's a noun, then we make it into a verb. It almost always takes the standard ED ending in the past tense. So texted would be the way most people would do it because that's kind of a meta rule of English. It's a rule that generates new rules. And one meta rule is when we coin a new word, we put the regular old ending on it. Just like if we have Google and we make it into a verb, then it naturally becomes Googled.
I wonder if John's referring to almost the fact that the text sound almost sounds like it's got an ED on the end, in the same way that some people, instead of saying asked, will just say ask for the past tense. It's sort of like a slip up in pronunciation.
Right. There's a couple of consonants there. T and D are similar consonants. They differ just by whether you vibrate your vocal cords a tiny bit, but they're otherwise articulated in the exact same part of the mouth. And so if you, it can be hard to say texted and clearly articulate that next syllable. Yeah.
I'm sorry to say we have just seconds left, but do you, in fact, Lane, have a pet peeve that you wish people would stop saying?
Yeah, let me put my flag down here for literally. I love literally. It's a great word when you can use it literally. It really packs a punch. I made a joke in a blog post once. I said the pet store's plane exploded over Florida and it was literally raining cats and dogs. that's what literally should be used to mean. It can mean that you're using a figurative expression in a literal sense, and it really has an effect that's just absolutely magical when you do it right. So saying, oh, it was literally a million miles away when it was literally 5 miles away, just robs a great, it takes a great word out of the language. And so I'd like to make my fight for literally. I'm going to keep it up.
Well, I will wish you luck, although I think it's a losing battle.
I hope not.
Robert Lane Green is my guest. His book is called You Are What You Speak, Grammar Grouches, Language Laws, and the Politics of Identity. He'll speak tonight at the Ginger Man, the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth's Young Professionals Group at 7 o'clock. Lane, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been great to have all of you listening, commenting, offering your thoughts, and asking your questions this hour. We are so excited when we have a guest that you can interact with fully and really engage. It's something that we're proud of being able to do on this program. program. Someone is paying for this program, and it may not have been you in the past, but some listeners' dollars are contributing 61 cents for every dollar that it costs to produce this show every day. Think about that, and think about the value to yourself and to the community of joining that esteemed group. Please don't count on someone else to always do it. Step in, become a member. Even at the most basic level, your support really makes a difference to us.
They literally call the number.
They will, yes. No, actually, you can literally call the number.
And Jackie, our pledge producer, is saying, we literally need your support.
Yes, and Lane would approve of that use. We do literally need your support.
Yes, we do. 888-694-6931. She's Chris Boyd. I'm Jeff Whittington. You can get a copy of our guest's book, Robert Lane Greene's You Are What You Speak, Grammar Grouches, Language Laws, and the Politics of Identity. When you join the station today at the $120 membership level, sorry to everyone who called and emailed in and we couldn't get to your question. But, you know, we know that these shows, these kinds of topics are really popular with you, and that's why we like to do them on the show. That's why we like to talk to these guests. If you get something out of it, if you appreciate it, please support the station today. Literally, only with your support can KERA continue to produce this show and provide all the national programs that you love and listen to as well.
Yeah, here's the reality. It's expensive to produce a program from within a local station. We're really proud to be able to bring you this show, but it costs money to have people on staff dedicated to producing one program alone. And it's also very expensive to have programs produced elsewhere that we pay membership fees in order to be able to broadcast. And KERA pays a heck of a lot because we have such a large audience. We are delighted to have each and every one of you with us, and we wouldn't want any of you to go away. But honestly, as the audience grows, so does our obligation to pay for the programming that comes to this station from other places.
And you should know that our shop here is really low to the ground. We have a very small staff for the number of hours we do and bring you every week on the Think Show and on the Anything Show. By comparison, a show like the Diane Rehm Show, which we are thrilled to carry, which we get from NPR, which we pay for.
And that's 2 hours a day.
It's also 2 hours a day. They have several producers. I think they have four or five, maybe even six producers on staff that work on the show. I would need to fact check that to make sure. But I know they have a much larger staff. So, you know, you're actually getting something, a really good deal.
A value.
On the Think Show. When you support KERA. And you also, we'll throw in the Diane Rehm Show, too, and Fresh Air, and All Things Considered, and Morning Edition.
And Car Talk, please.
Car Talk. And all the other shows that you listen to. You know what? Who understands this and who supports it is Susie Hyped and Keller. Also, Omar Alhamed and Arlington, Leah Montez and Carrollton and Libby Jansen and Colleyville. How do I know they understand it and get it? Because they've helped pay for it by calling 888-694-6931. Thanks, folks. They also may have gone online to kera.org.
If you go online, you can check out all the thank you gifts, which include, of course, Lane Greene's book, You Are What You Speak. They also include anything that you've heard us mention earlier in the week, except occasionally we have ticket offers that are gone. But if you thought, well, I wanted to make a contribution, but they haven't talked about this thing that I heard about or these Ken Burns DVDs or something, all that is available. The best place to find a full listing if there's a thank you gift that's going to motivate you is just to go online to kera.org. You can also ask, though, if you make the call at 1-888-694-6931. Hey, thank you so much, Anthony and Kimberly Dunbar in Plano, Joe Sheppen in Plano, and Michelle Grandin in Plano.
We'd love to thank you. Call us 888-694-6931 or contribute online at kera.org. We did hear from Kay Boroff in Dallas. Thanks, Kay. Thanks to Graham Wood in Dallas and Kelly Meyer in Denton. Be the next one, 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Chris Boyd across from me here is the one really that does the work of six producers because you'll find that Chris, when you listen to the show day in and day out, Chris is very well prepared for the interview. And we would not have this show the way it is if we didn't have someone who works as hard as Chris. And so that's another reason that you should support this program because it's a unique program. And yes, we talk to some of the same people that some of the national shows talk to as well, but we always bring the perspective from right here in North Texas to the interview. And of course, you get to call in or write in and participate in those shows.
This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas-Fort Worth-Denton, 100.1 K261 KCW Tyler, 88.3 K202DR Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV Sherman. The reason, and that's so nice of you, Jeff, thank you. The reason that both Jeff and I work so hard is because we know what a privilege it is to do this show for you. It's a lot of fun. We get to interact with you and to serve you, and it really is our pleasure. And we are ever thankful and really excited when we find out that you are willing to support us with your dollars, because, you know, you have a lot of choices, a lot of things sort of pulling on your budget. When you make a little space in that budget for the radio station that you listen to every day, that really means something. We know that we can't compel you to do it, but we are so grateful to those of you who take this on as part of your responsibility as listeners to the station. We would love to hear from you now online at kera.org. You can also make your contribution of support at 1-888-694-6931. Up next, we will have a story about an amazing ultra marathoner.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.